Good morning. I'm Cal Winslow, your host, and this morning, welcome back to our series and to the last segment in this series, Where Are We Now? Our purpose has been to examine some of the most urgent concerns: climate change, international conflict, gender, race, and inequality, and the state of the Earth's diminishing resources, and especially now as we enter this period of transition. You can see a list of all these conversations, by the way, and you can access them quite easily by going to Where Are We Now on the KZYX homepage. So this morning, we're going to conclude the series by considering the state of things in the Bay Area and in California. Our guest is Professor Richard Walker. He's a professor emeritus in geography at the University of California in Berkeley. His books include The Atlas of California, The Country and the City, The Greening of the San Francisco Bay Area, also The Conquest of Bread, 150 Years of California Agribusiness, and The Capitalist Imperative and the New Social Economy. His newest book is not quite out yet. It's forthcoming from PM Press, and it's called Pictures of a Gone City, The Making of the San Francisco Bay Area. Professor Walker was educated at Stanford and Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. He's the past chair of the California Studies Association, and as you might guess, much more, another long CV for us. Good morning, Professor Walker.
Well, good morning, Cal. Thanks for having me, and I'm glad to see that I'm part of a long and distinguished list of people with big CVs.
Okay, and I can call you Dick, right?
Of course.
Well, let's start off with your, we might say, your career. You've been studying and teaching about and writing about California, and especially the Bay Area, for quite a while now. Tell us about getting into this field and maybe where you think things stand now. What are the issues facing people in the larger Bay Area, and I suppose California as well, from your point of view?
Well, there's a small question. Well, I got into it basically because I grew up here in the Bay Area. I did go off to graduate school and learn to study much larger worldly issues. And for most academics, that's what you do. And to do the local is often regarded as very parochial. But I was, you know, heavily influenced by Mike Davis back in the 1980s. We became pals, and he was working on City of Quartz on L.A. And I realized that writing about California and the Bay Area is something that was worth doing, that it had been underanalyzed, particularly in recent years, and people didn't take it as seriously as they should. So, I don't know, I kind of backed into it that way and ended up partly because it's what I've learned about a lot and what I taught about a lot over the years, California agriculture, California water, California in general, that, you know, it kind of became my specialty, California and the Bay Area. So for better or worse, that's what I ended up an expert on.
Okay, and it's a big subject. We hear that, I may be wrong on this one, we're the sixth, seventh, eighth biggest economy in the world. So important, is that good for us? Is that a problem?
Well, it's certainly true. It varies depending on where we are in the business cycle. We bob up and down. I mean, we were recently hit fifth again, as we had in 1999. Then we fell all the way down to 10th or 11th, something like that, depending on how you measure it. Well, it's a good thing for California in the sense that it's nice to be prosperous. It's better to be, you know, rich and healthy than poor and sick. But, of course, it creates enormous problems and issues and challenges because we're one of the most important places in capitalism in the world today and have been for a long time. We're, in many ways, the engine of U.S. growth. So this is a powerhouse, and it's meant massive urbanization, massive environmental change, massive demographic change, and so on. And those are things I like to talk about and things I'm talking about in my new book.
Okay, and prosperous. So I guess we're out of the long recession now, although people still talk about it. What's your impression of how have we recovered? Have we gotten things back? Are we moving ahead? There still seem to be problems with poverty, education, health, and welfare.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, we're talking about uneven geographic development. So as a geographer, that's for one of the first things you have to know is how uneven capitalism is and development is and wealth and poverty are. So California is exceedingly uneven as a part of a larger unevenness that makes us very prosperous by comparison with Alabama or with Vietnam. At the same time, the interior of California, the agricultural valleys, the mountain areas, far northern California, where you are, the prosperity is much less, and in fact, the poverty can be really intense. And unemployment rates are often still over 10%. So it might feel in parts of California like you're still never got out of the Great Recession, because you have to remember those interior parts, the Great Recession hit, it was like the Great Depression. I mean, there were counties with unemployment rates over 30% and collapse of the housing market and 50% foreclosures and so on. On the other hand, you know, if you look at the Bay Area, the 9 or 12 county Bay Area, this is the hottest hot spot in the world. It's the world center of tech. So it's booming. It's filthy rich. It's created lots of jobs and so on. So here, it's hard to remember the Great Recession. And then, even within the Bay Area, of course, the distribution of wealth and prosperity brought by the tech boom is extremely uneven.
So, Dick, when you say the hottest of the hot spots, is that just a flourish rhetoric, or what do you mean by that?
I know. People think I'm being hyperbolic. You know, it's funny. People don't even who live in the center of the Bay Area, they know it's prosperous, but they don't realize that this is like the hottest hot spot in the world right now. What's hotter? You know, it's not Wall Street. It's not London. It's not even Shanghai. They may have more production in Shanghai and the greater Shanghai. New York, of course, is still the world financial center along with London. But this is the tech center of the world, and all those toys that everybody plays with and all the internet and everything is overwhelmingly comes out of this place, is invented in this place, is designed in this place, is manipulated in this place, and so on. So it not only is incredibly prosperous in terms of jobs created and money made and so on, but it affects people around the world. I mean, literally billions of people who are staring at their little cell phones, you know. The design of the operating systems, the basic design of the smartphone, for example, comes out of here. And so do, you know, a whole host of other things that people care about. I mean, 7 of the top 10 internet portals are based in the Bay Area. That doesn't mean that the server farms are here, because the internet is distributed. But internet isn't just everywhere. And internet innovation and the key softwares or the key pieces of it are designed in certain places and run out of certain places. And this is one of those. And it's the greatest. And everybody recognizes it is the greatest.
Well, it depends on what we mean by great.
That's the thing is, I mean, if you don't, okay, you've got to start with accepting, okay, we're in capitalism, it's American capitalism, but people have to at least realize that they're in one of the hottest hot spots in the world. If you don't start from that, then you go, well, you know, we're still in the Great Recession, and it's horrible. No, this is as good as it gets. Now, then actually can give a sharper edge to a critique of capitalism. Because if this is as good as it gets, what do we still lack? What's still wrong? And there's lots that's still wrong in this place.
Okay, now we didn't talk about this, but maybe this isn't so far from your field. Could you give us a feeling about the history of this industry? Why Silicon Valley? What Silicon means? Just very briefly, but you know, which companies led it off, and how did they do it?
Yeah, sure. It actually goes back to radio electronics in the early 20th century. This was an important place for the development of early tube technology. In fact, the vacuum tube, which was the basis of all early electronics, was perfected by a guy named Lee DeForest, who lived in Palo Alto at the time. And then it became more elaborate tubes that peaked with World War II, with companies like Hewlett-Packard and Varian that made these giant tubes that were used for radar and sonar in the war effort. And because of that, post-war, during the Cold War era, the Bay Area was still doing tube technologies for the Defense Department for the Cold War, and also got involved with computing and became a center of early development of computing, of large computers. Then William Shockley, who was one of the co-inventors of the transistor, moved here and started a new company to do microelectronics, a new age of microelectronics. And out of his company came a whole series of other companies, people who actually couldn't stand Shockley because he was a real jerk and left very quickly, but they started companies like Intel and National Semiconductor and AMD and so on. So there was this proliferation of what's called solid-state electronics. And then the microcircuit, the sort of key, you know, complicated circuits on a chip, and the chip is silicon, and it's etched circuitry on a silicon chip, that became the basis of modern electronics that has grown and grown and grown. But then on top of that, so that's back in the 1960s, the microcircuit, so on. And Intel's still around, still making the, you know, Intel Inside is still there. Their slogan of making the key central processing chips for phones, for computers, and everything. And then, among other things, the personal computer was basically developed here, coming out of a research lab called Xerox Labs, interestingly enough, run by Xerox, but they never profited much from it. And the ideas of, like, the mouse and Windows operating system, so on, came out and then was grabbed by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak and became the Macintosh, the Apple computers, and other personal computers. And then, by the turn of the 21st century, we got the smartphone, and smartphone technology, which these guys have been playing with for years. But there's also other things like computer graphics and internet switching. Of course, with the internet, you get in the 90s and the 2000s Google. Before that was Yahoo, which is now, of course, on its last legs. But Google, the search engines, then in our time, we get Twitter and Facebook. And these things aren't all invented here, but because, like Facebook, the people who invent them move here because once you're involved in this industry, you want to be where the action is. You want to be where the other people doing this inventing and creating are. You need to be in close relationship with them, both to get parts you need and to share ideas. And the Bay Area is the place to do that, Silicon Valley. But now Silicon Valley has taken over most of the Bay Area economy as it has multiplied into more and more different segments. So that's my short history of the world.
Pretty good. Dick, but I it's very difficult for me. I've never been there to visualize something like Google. You know, what is it? I hear that there's a Google campus. We hear that people are bussed up and down the peninsula and live in San Francisco and take up all right. the nice apartments and go to work in at the campus at yeah. Google. This may not, again, be something that I don't know if you've been there, but can you visualize or help us to see what is this Google? What's its campus? What do they do there?
Well, God knows. I mean, they have so much money, and they're investing everything from smart cars to server farms to artificial intelligence and so on. But, you know, they made their money basically on the Google search engine, which allowed people to look through all websites on the Internet and easily and find things. They have this brilliant algorithm that made their name. But then they made their money by coming up with brilliant other algorithms to
what
allow
is an
advertisers.
What's an algorithm?
Oh, it's just a method. It might be mathematical. I mean, that term algorithm comes out of mathematics, and it's just a mathematical formula for how the computer operates, how it searches. It's a kind of computer program.
Hmm.
And that's the one they figured out. If you looked at all the connections amongst websites, that was your best way to find out which ones were the most important and put them at the top of your search. So that's what they did, and then they figured out how to make money out of that. And what happens is you go from they went from being these little struggling startup, which is this is what we hear about all the time, is startup, startup, startup. But if you look at the Bay Area economy and the tech economy, it has all these little startups are kind of like the small fish swimming around the piers. But the big sharks are monopolists, essentially, you know, Facebook, Google. These are monopolists in the realm that they have established. They're like old IBM or like Microsoft used to be. They really have so much of the market share that almost no one squeezes in on their action. So they make unbelievable amounts of money. You know, they just pile up literally billions and billions and billions.
Where is it coming from, advertising? Or?
Yeah, it's mostly from advertising. That's right. Because it's not general user fees.
So if I'm a smart kid from Stanford or some other place, I get a job there. I go down on the bus. What's my work? What am I doing?
Well, you may be programming.
Yeah.
You may be. A lot of it is unglamorous coding.
Yeah.
But others is trying to figure out markets. Others is liaisons with other companies, trying to come up with strategic alliances to share technology. Some of it is, they must have very big financial offices, for sure, to deal with all that money. I mean, all the tricks they play, parking their money offshore and so on, and using fake pricing internationally so they can keep their profits in Luxembourg or in Holland or wherever they're paying fewer taxes. So, you know, I'm not an expert on the programming side of this, but I sure am well aware of what's going on with the money. And it's volcanic, the amount of money that's just erupting in this place. And that's, you know, it's not just that we're the tech center making things. It's that so much money flows into this because people want the products, but also, and this is really important, advertisers want to be in on the action. So that's classic capitalism. So they're paying for advertising because they pull their old advertising out of newspapers and magazines and TV and now stick those trillions of dollars into advertising online. And then lastly, and I think this is something that people don't appreciate enough, is there's just a lot of funny money, a lot of loose surplus capital running around the world because the world economy is not that great. It's been pretty stagnant since the Great Recession. And that surplus capital, a lot of it flows into the Bay Area as venture capital, as angel investment, as simply investment in stock in Bay Area tech companies. And it's literally trillions of dollars.
And some of this, you know, is new to lots of people. Angel investments, what's that?
Angel investors are just guys with a lot of money who are interested in risky, innovative, you know, sort of vanguard ideas. And it's been organized for a long time by these venture capitalist firms who are experts in setting up new firms and getting them managers, getting them financial operating officers, getting teams of engineers together and so on, so they'd actually try to succeed. Angel investors don't go through the established venture capital firms. They just do it on their own. And some of them are actually the same people. And some are just independent, wealthy people who think they know what a good idea is.
And are these people who basically can afford to take a chance? They can lose sometimes and it won't finish them?
Well, this is the great thing about being filthy rich.
Yeah.
You can take risks and get high rewards, and that's what they do.
Okay.
And, of course, they pat themselves on the back for being risk-taking, but it's easy to be risk-taking when you have lots of loot. And the rich tend to win, because if you're playing a game where there's a fairly assured return in the long run and over a lot of bets, then if you have a lot of money, you'll continue to win. If you don't, you may get in and then get burned. And that's an old principle of the stock market and all investing.
Let's pause here for a minute. This is KZYX. It's Mendocino County Community Radio. And I'm your host this morning, Cal Winslow. And our program is the last in our series, Where Are We Now? Our guest this morning is UC Berkeley Professor Emeritus Richard Walker, and he's been talking to us mostly about, kind of Silicon Valley and the wealth of the Bay Area. And I'm not sure I even wanted the thought about the discussion going in this direction, but you mentioned cars, which is not something that I would normally associate the Bay Area with. I was recently horrified, really, by a visit to Detroit to do some work there. Coming back, I read that Tesla is actually now bigger, I guess, financially than General Motors. Am I right about that?
I think it just passed Ford.
Okay.
And it hasn't quite hit General Motors. But this is a very good example of what I was just talking about. On the one hand, Tesla, as an electric car maker, is in a vanguard part of the automobile, the vehicle industry. And it shows that electronics is in everything now. So electronics is transforming the world in a lot of ways. And most of us know, suddenly Uber is displacing taxis all over the world. But that's because of the Uber app and the fact that you can do all this through smartphones and little electronic devices, and it can all be organized electronically, and you can transform a whole industry. Well, Tesla's trying to do that with cars through electric motors and battery technology. But in addition, the other thing I was talking about is that there's so much money, loose money running around, and Tesla's hot, and suddenly, you know, billions of dollars flow in to invest, millions, even billions, to invest in a company like Tesla. And how Tesla can be more valuable than Ford when it produces, one-tenth the number of cars,
yeah,
most, is astounding. And it's crazy. And the whole Bay Area is crazy in a way. And, you know, I don't want to sound just like a cheerleader here, because this enrichment, this is one of the major centers of the development of inequality today, a subject that people on the left are talking about, that everybody's talking about, the problem of inequality. Well, that inequality is mostly at the top. And And especially in this place, where average working class wages are not as horrible as they are in a place like Atlanta or Houston. But what the inequality is produced overwhelmingly at the top by this production of millionaires and billionaires. We have more billionaires per capita than any place on earth. And then this kind of money that just flows in to invest in whatever. And some of it, of course, is just pushing all this, tech apps and so on, some of which are actually kind of silly, like maybe food delivery apps. I don't know how useful are those to the future of humankind, or Twitter, or, phone games or whatever it might be. And some of it is just like, just bloating up the value of companies. I mean, Apple has been the world's most valuable company now for the last decade or so. And, why is that? It's because so many investors, that's the hot thing I'm going to invest in. So it's not just that consumers say, I've got to have the iPhone 7, and I guess now 8 is about to come out. It's also that investors say, I got to have a piece of that. And so all this money comes flowing in. The result is there's too much money in the Bay Area. And the other result that everybody talks about and everybody bitches and moans about is, of course, the housing crisis.
I'm going to ask you about that, but just so that we're sort of clear on what we're talking about, what do you mean by the Bay Area? I mean, I suppose we know San Francisco, Berkeley. We drive through Marin, and is Sonoma in the Bay Area? Give us a picture. You are a geographer of what we're talking about, and there must be a certain amount of unevenness there. You were talking about the importance of understanding when things aren't even.
Well, absolutely. Most people, when they think of the Bay Area, they only think of San Francisco. And I get raised eyebrows when I even say, San Jose is in the Bay Area, or Santa Rosa is in the Bay Area. They're both 50 miles away from the center of San Francisco. And people go, really? Oh, I thought that was different. And, of course, there are differences. There are important differences, the way they grew up and so on. But if you look at the connections of commuting, of the flow of goods, the flow of daily communications and information, company ties among companies, and so on, these are actually tightly integrated into the Bay Area, into this massive metropolitan complex. And that's the way cities are today. And we have a kind of old-fashioned notion of cities based on, it's that central, dense area like San Francisco or Manhattan. When, in fact, cities are these gigantic, sprawling complexes and have been for a long time. And they're also multi-centered. The modern metropolitan area of the world, in the U.S., but around the world, is multinodal, multi-centered. So you've got San Francisco, you've got San Jose, you've got the Palo Alto-Stanford node, you've got Oakland, and that's a little sub kind of thing in Berkeley going because of the educational complex here. And so on, with the 680 corridor, with Santa Rosa and up the North Bay, another little node around Napa, and so on and so on. So there's all these sub nodes. And then the area just keeps getting bigger. It keeps sprawling outward and outward, and even as it goes up and gets richer and more concentrated at the middle, it's just flowing outward like, like lava coming out of a volcano. It's building the island. It's spilling out into the Central Valley. People are commuting from places like Modesto and Turlock and Stockton and Vacaville and Cloverdale and so on, all the way down into jobs, maybe not in San Francisco, although some are, but maybe in Oakland or maybe in the 680 corridor, you're coming all the way from Modesto or Lathrop or something like that. And the census now actually recognizes that. It in 2010, it expanded the Bay Area from the usual 9-county Bay Area that edges the Bay to a 12-county Bay Area that includes San Joaquin County, for example, and Santa Cruz County, because the connections have become so deep amongst those. And when you add them all up, you got 8.5 million people. And this is the fourth biggest urban area in the United States. So it's huge. You know, L.A. is second after New York, Chicago's third, and we're fourth.
And so how about L.A., Dick? Are we a separate world from L.A.? Are we two competing big nodes, or what's the connection, do you think?
Well, this is, you know, one of the most interesting questions for people who study California. And most of us think of, most people who live in California think of Northern Southern California as never the twain shall meet, rivals and so on. Giants fans hate the Dodgers and vice versa. But actually, the connections between the two areas have always been very deep. If you just take electronics today, or for a long time, most of the new computer-generated special effects in movies came out of the Bay Area with Pixar and Electric Light and Magic, George Lucas's operation. And then was imitated, and they set up shops down in Hollywood to do similar things. But the kind of flow of people and ideas and subcontracts and so on is pretty deep between the two areas, even though Hollywood clearly the center of film action to this day. There's a big kind of sub-center in the Bay Area. And other things, like now Snapchat, which was started by some Stanford grads and has become this huge thing, really, in many ways, passing up Twitter, certainly amongst the young, is down in L.A. now. And so that's giving L.A. another big piece of electronics. But they've always had a lot. They always had a lot of military electronics, and the Bay Area always did some military electronics for L.A. Aerospace, and so on. And I could go on and on. So there's a lot of connections as well as a lot of rivalry.
Okay. Well, the other side of the coin, you've mentioned inequality, and I'll get back to, I think, later the issue of As Good As It Gets. But, you know, of course, for the country bumpkins like us, we come to San Francisco, it glitters, but off the beaten track just a step, and we see horrific scenes of displacement and homelessness and filth. And how does that come about? How do we have this incredible scarcity in the midst of the prosperity you've been talking about? I know that's a central question, but we have to say, that sometimes it's just awful to go into San Francisco.
Well, yeah, I mean, the homeless problem is appalling. And, you know, we can all have different views on how, about the homeless and about how to treat them and what kind of solutions there might be. None of them are clearly easy, which is why the homeless problem just goes on and on. Because once people are out on the street for a while, if they weren't crazy before, it makes them kind of crazy. And if they weren't hireable before, they're absolutely not hireable or really can't re-enter into normal society in most of them. So it's a real problem once it's established. Now, it's been going on now for 35 years. It was the Reagan administration and late the first Jerry Brown administration that cut housing subsidies, massive, the first big waves of unemployment layoffs from the restructuring of the world economy started back in the 80s. Reagan cut housing and other kinds of redistributions to cities and states that helped them to support people like that. And there was this you know, plan we could argue about emptying out the mental hospitals. And, of course, the fact that the U.S. doesn't have a good health care system and is hopeless with mental health. And you get a lot of these isolated people. And then the drug, you know, the drug epidemic, which is not unrelated to any of the above. So a lot of these people on the street have drug problems, alcohol problems. They have mental health problems, very high percentages. And also, you know, they fell out of housing. They couldn't find cheap housing, and they couldn't find sort of low-wage jobs. It disappeared, or they weren't, you know, weren't competitive for anymore. So, but it's appalling, and it's an American disgrace. It's everywhere, but it's very strong in California, for sure. And the reason, probably the main reason it's so high in California is, which has, you know, a lot of employment, has created lots of jobs and prosperity and so on, has got to be the cost of housing. Housing is a huge element in this. And homelessness is kind of the you know, the filthy edge, the really deplorable edge of a larger problem of housing displacement and overpriced housing.
And there are, I don't know, we would say very liberal local regimes in place these days. I think there's a new liberal mayor of Berkeley. There's a greenish party in Richmond. I think they talk about housing. Is there any hope for reform in the cities and towns like that?
Not really, because local governments can't solve this. They don't have the means. San Francisco puts hundreds of millions into homelessness and homeless programs, and they're just constantly overwhelmed. They're both overwhelmed, and they're such deep issues of people who are on the street that you can't get them off once they're out there for a long time. So without going into that, because that's a whole nother discourse, and I'm not expert enough to make claims about that, but it is clear that local governments can't solve it. It's a national issue, and it was national programs, a large part in cutting of housing subsidies that helped trigger it, as well as problems about this over weirdly uneven economy where people are desperate, unemployed, end up, you know, on the road from Kansas or wherever, come to California and end up homeless in L.A. or in San Francisco or Oakland. And, we can't solve that. Now, I'm not saying you could solve it easily, but you have to look, if you can just come back to housing markets and employment, on the one hand, you need a national employment program, something like the New Deals, WPA, and CCC, for marginal people, people who really have a rough time getting jobs, a lot of young people who can't get into the job market, people of color who can't get in the job market. You need government programs, and there's lots that could be done, and it wouldn't cost actually all that much, as the New Deal proved. And that, so you need that, because you've got to stop producing people who can't find meaningful work, meaningful lives, end up on drugs or alcohol because of that, or end up drifting west in hopes of something will happen, then end up getting off the bus in L.A. and ending up amongst the 60,000 or whatever it is, 50,000 homeless in L.A. So the other thing you need is housing programs, and those have been cut, and you need massive money into housing. The Bay Area, you can see it real clearly. The Metropolitan Transportation Commission has literally billions to distribute to highways, to BART, bus systems. And we could talk about how they distribute that because most of it goes to highways. But they've got some money. And they recently, there's been this big plan, Bay Area discussion, and so on about where new housing should go and so on. But the irony of it is that the one agency has all this money for transportation, And we can see, even so, Jerry Brown just asked for more taxes and more money because our roads are falling apart. Okay, so even the billions that come from the Fed for transportation aren't enough. What about housing? They don't give anything. They give pittance. You know, there's a little housing subsidy, Section 8, stuff like that. And it is pathetic. There's no massive housing program, but that's what you need. You need a housing program on a par with a transportation program to even make a dent in the problem of housing supply at the bottom end.
So I know you've gone over this, but let's just go over it one more time so we can all be clear. On the one hand, you're saying there's so much money in the Bay Area. On the other hand, you're saying there's not enough money for bases. Can we just try squaring that?
Yeah. Well, it has to do with our tax system. I mean, there's all this money piling up, and it's not taxed. Not enough of it is taxed. And, you know, if we've cut taxes on the rich and taxes on corporations and business, taxes on property, by the way. And property tax is not just, you know, important because without it you can't fund schools and local government. But Prop 13, by cutting property taxes, cut off one of the most progressive taxes because rich people, richer people and businesses own more property. And the poorer people are renters and have less property. Or no property at all, real property. So that also cut off a progressive form of taxation. So our taxation is less at the top. It's become more regressive. California's tried to compensate for that with some progressive tax efforts. But mostly California does not tax per dollar, per capita per GNP rate as high as it did back in the post-war era when we had some of the best public schools in the country, for example, when they built the California highway system and the California water system, whatever you might think of that. Now, but we were able to do things because we had money, because we taxed a prosperous economy. And today we don't tax enough. And that is, of course, partly federal, Reagan and so on, and Clinton and Bush cutting taxes over the years. It's also, of course, California, because California was a center of the neoliberal tax-cutting movement, starting with Prop 13. It wasn't just Prop 13. There were other propositions and laws passed that limited taxation or made it more regressive. So we don't have enough public money. Public money we lack, and private money we've got far too much of.
Okay. So
that's our basic problem.
I got you. So for the younger generation, just tell us what Prop 13 was very quickly, and also speculating about taxation, hypothetically, could we tax more? Could we get more into the public domain?
Yes, we could. I mean, there are think tanks in Sacramento who have looked at this and have looked at California's tax effort, and we could certainly tax more than we do without penalizing the economy, without damaging economic growth, whatever. And, of course, it has to be progressive. There's just a lot of excess money at the top, people making too much off their stocks and their landed real estate investments and so on, that should be more heavily taxed. So it's very possible to raise taxes. This is an incredibly rich and dynamic economy. If you can't raise taxes in this place, you can't do it anywhere. Now, California does already, of course, have higher taxes than Idaho or Nebraska or some other states. But most of those other states have low taxes because they have much less prosperous and wealthy economies. And they're scared to death to chase away business and so on. They're only way of attracting business and people is to claim that, well, we don't have any property taxes, we don't have any sales taxes or whatever. California doesn't have to do that because California is the dynamic place that invents new things. It doesn't have to attract other people's capital, other people's businesses, because we create the new businesses that everybody else wants. Everybody, every place in the world wants to be Silicon Valley. So we have a huge leg up, and we could do much better.
Okay, and let's pause again for a moment. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host, Cal Winslow, and this morning we're talking with Professor Richard Walker of the University of California at Berkeley, and we've been talking a lot about the economy, the state of the economy, what's good, what's bad, what might be done. Richard, let's shift the subject here a bit. I knew you were working on a new project and that it had to do with California, but this idea of is it Gone City or what? Well, that's kind of gulp. What's happening? What are you thinking here?
Well, there's this title, Pictures of a Gone City. It's taken from a poem by Ferlinghetti written back in the Beat era. And it starts out, it says, the world is a beautiful place. Basically, if you don't notice all the problems around you, if you can step over the homeless, it's a beautiful place. And he's very aware of the contradictions of the wealth and poverty and success and failure in the city. And he's kind of writing it about San Francisco back in about 1950. But that contrast is even more intensive today. And so I like that because he's trying to capture that two-faced, that Janus-faced aspect of a very successful urban center, metropolitan area, and that's what I'm trying to do, too, is say, okay, this is incredibly successful, incredibly wealthy. What's the downside? Okay, the obvious one we talked about was homelessness. But, you know, people are being driven out that working-class people can't afford this. Working-class, there's still a huge working class in the Bay Area who make minimum wage, like a quarter of all workers in the Bay Area. It's incredible. This is the wealthiest city in the United States on a metropolitan level per capita. It may be the richest in the world. It's certainly in the top five. Okay, and yet you have a third, half, quarter, or maybe a third of the population who are making minimum wage, who really can't even afford, barely can afford to live here, and are being driven out by high rents, by high cost of living, of which, you know, rents and home costs are the biggest element. So what is that about? I mean, that's crazy. So this pressure on working people is intense. So while the rich get richer, the workers who are sort of essential to this whole operation are under pressure. They can't find housing. Of course, always difficult to find health care in this country, and good health insurance, and so on. All right, so that's a fundamental problem. I'd love to talk more about housing if you want to do that, but that's been something that's really obsessed people. But then there's, you know, California, when we passed Proposition 13 back in 1978, and I didn't answer your question with that, was what's called the tax revolt, except that it wasn't just a popular tax revolt. It was a systematic effort by the Southern California Property Owners Association, that is the landlords, to get their properties detaxed. And it was led by a guy named Howard Jarvis, who was an old right-wing activist out of Orange County. And they managed to convince people, as property values were going up and older people felt pressured that they were going to lose their houses, so on, that they managed to persuade everybody to vote for this thing, and it's been a catastrophe for urban government, for metropolitan government, local government in California. And it spread like wildfire, but California did some other things. This, you know, we now see California as the most liberal place in the country, practically. particularly the Bay Area, but generally the coastal California. But boy, that's new. You have to remember California for 30 years was, or more, was like a heartland of neoliberalism, with all these criminalization, intensification of the war on crime. Prison building was our main infrastructure program for years. Putting term limits and shackling the legislature, passing proposition after proposition, often very bad policy, for criminalization or tax cutting or getting rid of bilingual education, things like that. So California had a pretty, very poor record for many years politically, and it's only turned around in the 2000s because our population's turned around, because the state was booming during this period and attracting so many immigrants, and immigrants' children and their children, the children are now grown and they're voting, and they are working class people of color by and large, and they're much more progressive than the people of our parents' generation who were voting for Prop 13 and three strikes laws and so on.
And a word about immigration and demographics. It's on everyone's minds these days. Do you, the question of inequalities and of, that's connected, isn't it, to the changing demographics of the state?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, the problem of inequality is quite general. It has to do with enrichment at the top, with tax cutting and financialization, and forcing down of the average wage or stagnation of the average wage and massive job losses and unemployment and shifting kind of job market, labor market for the working class. So, you know, whether you're in California or you're in Pennsylvania with old white stock workers, I won't call them native, but they will call them white, and they're old stock, Euro-American immigrants. And their jobs markets have been stagnant, their communities have been stagnant, and so on. But what's interesting is it isn't just a problem of stagnation and stagnant places like old parts of Pennsylvania, old industrial parts of Pennsylvania. It's also true in dynamic parts of California. And there, what employers did is, they broke unions as jobs grew in new sectors, they kept unions out. Electronics, for one, is notoriously anti-union and non-union. And that kept the wages down. And then they systematically hired immigrants when they could, because they could get them at a really, cheaper price, systematically cheaper. And they work hard. You know, they want to be here. They want to work. And over time, that meant that the working class was replaced. And the older white workers retired and moved on. And younger ones weren't hired, and instead immigrants were hired, and immigrants' children were hired. And so we got a completely new demographic, a completely new working class.
Okay, it's not really what we meant this program to be about, but of course, every single day the headlines are all about the president, and whether it's domestic or international, there's always some chilling news. Are we going to, we Californians, let's say that's how we identify that way, are we going to be able to stand up to what's in store for us, or maybe we don't even know what's in store for us? Should we be worried? Should we be gearing up? There's no answer to this, I know, but have you any thoughts?
Well, of course we should be worried. I mean, guy is kind of an egomaniacal businessman who pretty ignorant of the world and its problems, incredibly willing to, you know, cheat, lie, and steal. So, yeah, we should be very worried. But beyond that, I think everybody understands that. They don't need me to tell them that. But how much can California resist? Well, quite a bit. I mean, this is a huge chunk of the American economy and the American population. We have almost 40 million people out of the 300 and some million in the country. So we are the most important slice of this country. And we do have a state government, which you know, has certain important powers and is exercising those. So we have a more progressive population now, more progressive electorate, a more progressive culture here that's developed in the political culture that's come back in the last 10, 15 years. And we've got much better laws, say, on climate change, which do make a difference. California and its laws do both put pressure on car makers or home builders for more energy efficiency. And also, of course, help spur creative people, inventive people who are coming up with better software for automobiles or for building management and so on. So that's very important in keeping part of this country on the right track. And, you know, those things last. For example, back in the 1970s, two things happened in California when Jerry Brown was governor the first time, not necessarily entirely due to him. One was the last most serious drought in the mid-70s, which led to massively improved efficiency of water use. Household water use went down dramatically and stayed down. Energy. There were a whole set of local and state rules to improve automobiles and other and home energy efficiency, water heaters, and so on. And as a result, Californians have an average energy use that's comparable to Germans and much better than the average for the United States as a whole. So these things can have a long-term impact, and they're going to have it. On the other hand, you know, federal policy is superordinate and trumps, so to speak, California on a whole series of things. And that would include things like health care money, which California, you know, can't run covered California without federal funds. And thank heaven Obamacare wasn't thrown out. And California's, which has the best, I think, of all, or nearly the best of all the insurance exchanges, you know, can continue with that. So that's a plus. But other things like we need more housing money, we ain't going to get it. Are we going to get more transportation money? Well, it looks like we're going to have to raise it for ourselves. We're going to be able to build high-speed rail. Without federal money, I doubt it. So there's a whole series of things that are going to be tough on California, and we're going to have to fight both here in Sacramento and locally, and in Washington through our reps. And, you know, you can see that's going on. People are putting pressure on congressional representatives, on Senator Feinstein yesterday in San Francisco, and so on, to get them to oppose the Trump policies and hold them at bay. And that's, you know, in some ways the least, maybe the best we can do, but it's still really important.
Okay, well, this has been terrific, Dick. We've run out of time. I wanted to say a couple of things before you go. Listeners might want to look up a couple of Dick's books, which we didn't talk about, but up here lots of people are kind of environmental issue, and Dick's book, The Country and the City, The Greening of the San Francisco Bay Area, is well worth a read. Also, not so long ago, his book, The Conquest of Bread, about agribusiness in California. I said this is Cal Winslow, and the program has been Where Are We Now? And this, fittingly, I think, has been the last in the series, a series of programs you can find on the homepage of KZYX when you go online. But we've been very lucky to have the kind of guests, including Dick, that we've been able to bring to you. So, Dick, thank you very much again for myself, for all the listeners.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, and I hope I haven't bored people with battering on too much.
Not at all. And the listeners, thank you, and good morning.